Fred, where does the idea that nature is inherently balanced and can be perfected come from?
You might say it goes back to some religious teachings, but certainly ecologists from the first origins of ecology as a discipline in, I guess, the mid to late 19th century, have believed in this idea of the perfectibility of nature, the idea that evolution will deliver perfection, perfect ecosystems, so that species will co-evolve to produce, if you like, biological machines that are, you know, perfect, the perfect rainforest, the perfect coral reef, the perfect mangroves, whatever it may be. And those ideas come from some of the early thoughts about natural selection. So before Charles Darwin, there was Lamarck, the French scientist, who first got hold of the idea of evolution and articulated that and suggested that evolution was indeed designed to produce perfection of nature. Charles Darwin didn't hold that view himself. He saw species as simply sort of fighting best they could to maximize their own potential. But if you like, the sum total of species doing that was simply species doing their best to make out as best they could. It didn't result in any perfected system. But ecologists and the whole ecology movement, and including the thinking of conservationists following on from that through the 20th century, has kind of had it at the back of its mind, the idea of pristine, perfect ecosystems, and therefore pristine nature, which conservationists should be trying to protect. So we're always kind of referring back to an idea of a perfect ecosystem. So conservationists are always trying to recreate this when they see that humans have kind of messed with nature. So that's been a kind of central template of conservation thinking, and indeed most ecological thinking. But there is a second view which has been put around, almost as old as the first one, but it's been the minority view, that nature is much more kind of haphazard, that evolution doesn't deliver perfection but simply delivers what is useful for individual species, and that nature is dynamic and constantly moving on and constantly changing and doesn't head towards any notion of perfection. And that's a very different view of how ecosystems work, and obviously has profound implications for the kind of conservation that we should be doing. Because then, in my judgment, conservation should be about helping maintain that dynamism, maintain the ability of nature to change and adapt and move on, rather than sort of constantly referring back to an idea of perfection. So they're very different views about how evolution works, how ecosystems work, and also what the purpose of conservation should be.
You mentioned this idea of pristine ecosystems and wrote an entire chapter about what you call the myth of the pristine. You write that one reason humans may embrace this concept of the perfectible ecosystem is because we don't really know how to look at a landscape and understand that what we see as a virgin rainforest is really a very large abandoned garden from centuries ago. The African plains is another sweeping example that you cite. Now, granted, it isn't easy to discern that the rainforest was human-created, but that's not really all that's preventing us from seeing it, is it?
Well, we culturally, I think, as you say, like the idea of something pristine, nature as separate from us and as perfected. And we try and look for it, not just a sort of cultural goal, it's almost a kind of psychological need on behalf of humans, and I think we should recognize that. But if you try and find it scientifically, you simply can't find it. There are really no places in the world where we can say with any certainty or indeed probability that this is unchanged perfection. So the Amazon rainforest, the same as the rainforests in Central Africa and indeed Southeast Asia, are clearly regrowth from really very extensive human civilizations of the past when there were many, many more humans in these areas. Archaeologists have found evidence of whole cities in much of the Amazon, a lot of evidence that the soils in parts of the Amazon have been substantially changed over centuries by humans. We see evidence of iron smelting in Central Africa and very large amounts of forests being used and burned to do this smelting. And indeed, in the plains of Africa, more recently, we can see that the landscape was very substantially remade in the early 20th century as a result of the Rinderpest epidemic, which ran through the cloven-hoofed animals of Africa, hugely changed that landscape, and indeed much reduced the amount of cattle and the number of humans in that landscape as well. So when Europeans began seriously looking at, indeed at the moment of the scramble for Africa just over a century ago, what Europeans saw was a very unnatural, unexpected, almost unique situation in which nature was much more dominant over humans than it had been for hundreds and possibly thousands of years in Africa. So wherever you look around the world, there simply isn't pristine nature out there. We simply don't know what it was like. We know that most of the rainforests are regrowth from what was left by humans. In many cases, substantially, the trees that we find were planted by humans, their fruit trees and so on. You can see the Amazon as almost like an overgrown garden. Perhaps that's the best way to look at most landscapes around the world, is not as pristine nature, but as overgrown gardens. And again, I think this forces us to rethink what we imagine nature to be, and also to get rid of some of the preconceptions that we have, or the emotional needs perhaps we have about nature being apart from us and nature being somehow virgin. Really, it isn't. Probably for several thousand years, most of nature has been quite substantially influenced by humans. And I have to say, you know, it's done pretty well. It's not to say that it's a sort of a damaged or bastardized nature. It's simply a nature in which humans have been an important element. And the biodiversity of it stood up pretty well. Ecosystems have functioned pretty well. It's just that they weren't virgin. They weren't pristine systems. They were systems in which humans had a very large role.
Well, and as you point out fairly early in the book, a lot of the Northern Hemisphere at various points in history was really heavily glaciated. So the idea, what is a native plant in these locations, can vary based on how far back into history you look.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other aspect, is that, of course, just as humans have been changing nature and are large players in it, we should not imagine that before humans, nature was in any sense stable or unchanging. As I mentioned, we need to think about nature as dynamic, as constantly on the move, with species moving in, species moving out. There are many reasons for that, but climate change, natural climate change, is very clearly an important part of that. And as you say, in the Northern Hemisphere, when very large areas were glaciated, I'm speaking to you from the UK, which was virtually entirely glaciated until about 10,000 years ago. So on that time scale, everything in the UK, and you might say the same for much of North America, has moved in after the ice retreated. So the idea of what might be a pristine ecosystem, well, for a particular place, well, we can't really say that, because it depends on what the climate has been. And that, I think, has important implications for how we think about how nature will respond to human-induced climate change. I'm not saying that nature will cope with it fine, far from it, but nature will certainly respond, and nature will certainly try to adapt. And one of the perhaps important things for conservationists to think about now is how we help assist nature to respond to the inevitable climate change that is going to be. That's leaving aside the important issue of how we halt climate change or reduce its impact. But we simply have to help nature to respond to climate change in a principal way, in which nature, its species, individual species, whole ecosystems will tend to respond to climate change, will be simply by moving. Migration will be not the only adapting response, but an important one. So again, it gives us a new perspective on conservation, a new perspective on how we should think about doing what most of us want to do, which is help nature thrive in what people now talk about as the Anthropocene, the age of humans.
I know quite a few people who work on environmental issues, including conservation of biodiversity, protecting endangered species, and wild ecosystems. I've chatted with some of them about your book and the ideas in it. To a person, they were very dismissive of the idea that alien species belong any place other than where they came from, and mentioned that they cause native species to go extinct. That last point was brought up over and over again. You assert that science does not support this claim and that, in fact, the opposite is true. Alien species very rarely cause extinctions and actually increase biodiversity in almost all cases. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about those ideas, please.
It is extraordinary. I found it fascinating researching the evidence for the repeated claim and the presumption, I think, almost more than the result of any research, the presumption that alien species, invader species, migrant species, whatever you want to call them, cause extinctions among natives. I won't say they don't ever. Of course, occasionally it does happen, but it is remarkably rare. North America has a fifth more plant species than it did before Europeans showed up and started bringing old world species in. So a large addition to the number of species in North America, and just a handful of known cases of native species from North America, if we can call them native species, certainly, you know, the ones that have been native for a while, having disappeared as a result of the alien invasions. Now, of course, humans sometimes hunt species to extinction and that kind of thing. But as a result of the arrival of alien species, really very few. And not just North America. I mean, in the UK, in most of Europe, you can see example. Species have been constantly moving around, either for entirely natural reasons under their own steam or as a result of human activity of one sort or another, deliberate or accidental. And again, the net result is always increased biodiversity, more species than there were before, because the arrivals hugely outnumber any extinctions that might result. Even in places where I think we'd accept that there have been huge changes to ecosystems, or ones changes which many people are distressed about in Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii, places where there have been profound changes as a result of new arrivals, even in those places, the actual biodiversity is much greater than it was before. So if we take a simple measure, as many people do, that a more biodiverse ecosystem is a healthier ecosystem, is one which will be able to provide more ecosystem services in the jargon, help protect against climate change, protect water resources and that kind of thing, and will be more resilient to other kinds of threats to it. If we accept that biodiversity does all those things, then it looks like alien species are good in that sense. Now, I wouldn't say that there are never any problems with them, but as a generality, migrant species moving around the world look like they're good for nature, they're good for ecosystems, they rejuvenate things, they kickstart things. And especially in a world in which humans do damage, climate change, pollution, hacking down forests, draining marshes, all the kind of things that we do, which undoubtedly damage nature. It seems to me that alien species, migrant species are often a really rather good response from nature. Maybe they're part of the solution rather than part of the problem. It's a kind of radical new take on our conventional, very negative ideas about alien species. But it does, I think it holds water. I think it suggests that we have got into a sort of unscientific kind of emotional cul-de-sac in just believing that because aliens can change ecosystems, that means that they're bad. And again, this comes back to, I think, our sort of mythology about pristine ecosystems. If you do think that nature is perfectible, ecosystems are perfected nature, and ecosystems are pristine and should be protected exactly as they are, then of course alien species, migrant species coming in are damaging to that because they're causing change. But if you believe that change is part of how nature works, is part of the dynamism of nature, and indeed that evolution is about change, then it gives you a very different view. It means that you can imagine that alien species would be good, would be part of nature's response, perhaps to damage that humans are doing, or perhaps simply to natural change. And maybe we should be cheering the alien species on.
Fred Pearce is an award-winning author and journalist based in London, England. He writes frequently for New Scientist magazine and The Guardian newspaper. His latest book, which we're discussing, is The New Wild: Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. So, given this idea that alien species spur and enhance biodiversity, one might think it would make them favorites among those promoting biological diversity and the preservation of nature. But that doesn't really seem to be the case generally. Why do you think that is?
That's right. We have changed things a lot. We'll change things some more. I think we just have to be a little bit more pragmatic and understanding about the real nature of nature. Now, there are circumstances when we'll want to do something about an alien species. If it were, you know, plant disease coming in and doing damage to a forest or wrecking crops or something, I think there are perfectly arguable reasons why sometimes we want to do something about an alien species that shows up. But that's essentially because it's damaging to human activities, either economic or some landscape issue, or perhaps we simply just don't like the alien. You know, it's ugly, or it's maybe it's damaging some particular species that we're really rather fond of. So I'm not saying that it would be totally illegitimate for human wildlife managers ever to want to intervene to remove or control an alien species. But I think we should recognize that we're doing that for us. We're not doing that for nature. I think in the big picture for nature, successful migrant species are good for nature. You know, they're moving in, they're adding to biodiversity, they're being dynamic, they're probably frequently colonizing areas that the local native species haven't been able to colonize, or conduct activities in the environment that natives haven't been able to do. That's why they move in, that's why they're successful. So these kind of go-getter colonist species, it seems to me, are good for nature. They're certainly part of the dynamism of nature. They will be part of how nature constantly changes. And if we have that picture of nature in our minds, then that's the kind of thing that we should be encouraging. So as I say, I'm not saying that we should never want to intervene or never want to deal with an alien species that comes in and is causing a problem. But it's about us, and that's not really about nature. Real conservationists should be mostly cheering them on.
In the book, you repeatedly point out that when alien species become invasive, it's almost always due to something that humans did, knowingly or not. You mentioned Australia. I think most people know that rabbits are a huge issue there. A film was even made about it years ago. But that's a situation that was actually created by the human introduction of sheep to the country, which then radically altered the landscape and allowed the rabbit to proliferate in the way that it did.
That's right. It sure did proliferate. But I mean, yes, migrant Europeans, principally from the UK, moving there, occupying the land, using large amounts of it for sheep farming, had created an absolutely perfect environment for rabbits to take over. So when we introduced a few rabbits, I think the original idea was to do a bit of hunting. Very quickly, they ran across the country. But you can't really blame the rabbits. I mean, you know, the original problem, if it was a problem, you could argue about that, but the original spur for that was the human introduction of sheep and the changes to the grasslands that resulted from that. More recently, if you think about, you know, one of the kind of totemic alien species is the zebra mussel in the Great Lakes and moving into some of the rivers that supply the Great Lakes. Well, the zebra mussel got going in Lake Erie at a time when Lake Erie was basically a dead lake. It was so polluted, there was really very little life in it. The zebra mussels moved in because the native mussels couldn't really live in the lake effectively, certainly couldn't, as filter feeders, process the huge amounts of pollution there, so the lake had become sort of black. You couldn't see through it, you couldn't see to any depth, and there was very little life in the lake. The zebra mussels were able to cope with that. They could move into a very damaged ecosystem, an ecosystem damaged by human pollution. Not only could they live there, but they actually cleaned it up substantially. There are other reasons too, but a major reason why Lake Erie is a lot clearer than it was half a century ago is because the zebra mussels were able to move in, proliferated in very large numbers and caused some problems for human water intakes and jetties and things, but actually quite substantially cleaned up the lake, changed the ecosystem that's been bad for some species and good for others. Many species, including the endangered lake sturgeon, do a lot better now. They're eating zebra mussels, among other things. Clearing the lake resulted in vegetation starting to regrow on the lake bottom, which again has been good for some fish species. So while there's been substantial changes there, it is at least arguable that zebra mussels have been good for the lake ecosystem. And certainly, you could say, they were able to move in and proliferate as a result of the intense pollution that humans had put there. So we created, again, the circumstances where it could take off. Similar in the tropics, you see water hyacinth, a South African weed, a quite virulent weed, with a rather pretty weed, but many people won't like it, taking over lakes, including Lake Victoria in Africa, Africa's largest lake, proliferating across the lake because the lake was very polluted and the weed was moving in and was able to live well in that environment. So again, examples where alien species are moving in and doing very well in ecosystems that have been messed up by humans. So it seems to me, again, this is alien species moving in and doing good. They're nature's response to damage done by humans. And we should be very careful about thinking that they are the enemy. It's kind of easy to blame them when they're really at the cause of the initial problem. They are like a symptom of environmental problems in both these cases. You know, we shouldn't be blaming them. We should say, well, okay, if we're going to mess up the environment, nature's going to respond, and they are part of nature's response. So I think there are many examples, and we're going to see many more around the world, in which alien species are nature's response to the damage that humans are doing to the planet. And again, if we are serious about conservation, serious about helping nature get through the undoubted damage that humans are doing, then I think they're part of the solution and not part of the problem. We should be encouraging them.
You write about two instances of biological blank slates, something that's really rare on Earth. One story opens up the book, the other nearly closes it. So let's start with Ascension Island, where there is a human-created, completely functioning, entirely non-native cloud forest ecosystem. Why did you start the book with this story?
I think it's just such an interesting example. It's way out in the South Atlantic. It's 1,000 miles from any other island. So it's entirely out there on its own. It's a volcanic hulk, so it arose from the ocean bed a few million years ago. Very little life. There are a few ferns and some turtles showed up on the beaches, but not much else. When Europeans started using it as a sort of naval station in the early 19th century on a regular basis, they began to import species. You know, it was a very barren-looking place, and they wanted to bring in some trees and make it look nicer. And they succeeded spectacularly well, especially bringing in trees. So UK British naval ships were bringing, on their way back from the British Empire, from Australia, from South Africa, from India, from the Caribbean, all over the world, as their ships were coming back to the UK, they were dropping off tree seedlings. The local naval ratings, not a lot else to do, they started planting them. And they did very well. Not only did the trees sort of sit there like in a big garden, but some insect species came with them, and the insect species started flitting around between trees. So insects from South America seemed quite happy to pollinate Australian trees or whatever it was. And within a few decades, an entirely sort of accidental cloud forest ecosystem was created on Green Mountain, which had been a completely barren mountain in the middle of Ascension Island. So it's a fascinating example of really what shouldn't happen according to the conventional idea of ecology, the conventional idea that a forest ecosystem will be a result of kind of coevolution over long periods of time. Every species will have to evolve its own particular niche, and that's how any ecosystems are created. But here we have something which is just a more or less a random collection of species showing up as a result of what sailors happened to leave behind on the island, and yet appears to be an entirely functioning ecosystem. So I found it a fascinating model to suggest that, well, maybe much of nature is like that. Maybe much of nature is much more accidental than we imagine, much less a result of a brilliant evolutionary process. So again, suggesting an accidental nature rather than pristine, perfected nature.
Well, again, there's this idea of when do we observe something playing into this? Our perception is of a seemingly perfected ecosystem, but we obviously couldn't observe it 5, 10, 15, 100,000 years ago, when it all may have started with random introductions of various sorts of different species, and over time, they just grew together into what we see as the functioning community.
Islands show this quite well. I mean, you could go to Hawaii and you say, well, that looks like a brilliant, very unusual ecosystem that they have there. for outside species were being brought there by humans. You know, Hawaii, again, is volcanic islands that arose out of the Pacific maybe 10 million years ago, something like that. The species that are there are really very often just the ones that happened to show up because they were could arrive on in the guts of birds or on driftwood or however they got there. But again, a really similarly rather random process. So I think we have to get our heads around the idea that much of nature is much more random than we imagine. And therefore, when humans are moving species around the planet, we're not so different from what nature does itself.
Okay, so now for the other blank slate, the island of Surtsey, south of Iceland.
Yep, Surtsey again was a volcanic eruption from the seabed south of Iceland, in this case 50 years ago, almost exactly 50 years ago now. And it's interesting because scientists from Iceland followed it from day one. As soon as it was cool enough to set foot on the island, they turned up. They took some precautions not to bring species from Iceland themselves. They were fairly careful about that. And they just kind of waited to see what showed up. And they found that some things came in the plumage of birds, not just from Iceland, but birds crossing the Atlantic in regular migration patterns. Some arrived in the guts of birds. Some things arrived floating on the ocean, some seeds and so on. And a whole kind of mixture of just almost random things, whatever managed to get there by whatever route. Some things literally fell out of the sky from passing birds in their claws or in their wings. One or two things they now think may have shown up in the lunchboxes of the scientists, but hopefully not too many of those. And they charted the development over the last 50 years of a strange sort of beginnings of an ecosystem. Soon birds, some passing birds, decided that it looked pretty good there. There was a bit of food there with a few plants growing. So they would make nests there, and they started breeding there. But again, this wasn't something which was a result of a complex evolutionary process. Again, this was a kind of an ecosystem of whatever showed up just over a period of 50 years. But to all intents and purposes, that island is now an ecosystem. It won't last for so long because ocean erosion means that probably in a couple of hundred years or so, the island will disappear and will go back beneath the waves. So it's a rather temporary ecosystem. But it gives a snapshot of how, if you like, accidental nature works.
You end the book writing about novel ecosystems, which are basically human-modified natural ecosystems. You assert that these are not only the future, but also the present for much of the world. That nature doesn't go backward is an idea you mention early and often in the book. And to the extent that there were really ever pristine ecosystems, we obviously can't get back to that state. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about the importance of preserving these novel ecosystems as they exist, including things like secondary growth forests and even urban habitats.
I think most of the world really is now what one might term novel ecosystems. In other words, unpredictable mixtures of what was there before, though we know that what was there before was also constantly changing, but with inputs, accidental or deliberate, of human activity. So we're presented with a world which is constantly in flux, but also constantly in flux under the influence of humans. And much of it seems to work pretty well. And it's certainly inevitable. We can't go back to any idea of unchanging or pristine ecosystems, not least because the climate is changing, and that is a result, to some extent, certainly, of human activity. So we have to accept this. But let's revel in it. Let's enjoy what's there, and let's encourage what's there. I wouldn't use the word preservation of this because, again, we can't go backwards, but we can preserve the dynamism of it and encourage the dynamism of it. And we see that very often in urban environments, which many people don't regard as ecosystems at all. Many field guides to nature never mention urban ecosystems, but they're definitely there. In many ways, cities and areas occupied by human activity, industrial sites, railroad lines, that kind of thing, are brilliant places for nature because there are odd chemical niches, if you like, physical places, unusual habitats, which particular species turn up and find are ideal for them. So we get, again, really unusual, novel ecosystems or just places where species get on very well. And increasing amounts of nature, particularly here in Europe, is now in those kinds of places. Most bee species, for instance, in the UK are now found in these kinds of environments. We find many more insect species in general and quite a few plant species too in those kind of urban, industrial, or perhaps post-industrial, sometimes abandoned landscape. So this is part of nature now. It's an important part of nature. And I think conservationists have been guilty too much of ignoring these kinds of places because they're not pristine in the sense that we conventionally understand that. And you might say the same of logged over rainforests. Now, most conservationists are very keen to protect rainforests as the sort of center of biodiversity on the planet or on the land surfaces of the planet. But most rainforests are on different timescales emerging from human activity of one sort or another, may have been recently logged over. And a huge amount of biodiversity is still in those forests. The logged over rainforest still contains the majority of the species that it had before, and perhaps some new ones moving in as a result of the opening up of the landscape. But for whatever reason, under whatever circumstances, I think true conservationists have got to think about, well, a lot of nature is now in those places. Perhaps the majority of nature now is in habitats massively altered by human activity. So we have to think about how we coexist with such places. We can't cut ourselves off from nature. We can't pretend that we'll have this bit of the planet and we'll leave the rest of it to nature. For one thing, because the planet has already been changed much too much for that. And secondly, because in many ways it's not necessary. We can think in really creative ways about how we can coexist with nature. And that, after all, is better for us as humans. Humans thrive in an environment where we're in amongst nature, even if it's just in a sort of cityscape with parks. You know, it's good for humans. And if it's good for nature too, then I think we should think much more about living in amongst nature and finding good ways of living in amongst nature. Sometimes by being clever in the way that we do conservation, but maybe sometimes just standing back and letting nature be a bit wilder in urban and suburban environments. Give nature room to spread in amongst us. I think that's the future. That is the new wild, and that's why I use the title in the book. It's inevitable, but we can make it much, much better than we might imagine.
Do you think there's a need for a focused urban conservation and urban biological preservation effort?
I think there's huge scope for urban conservation, finding ways to allow nature to come back in cities. It'll come back anyway. You know, it'll fight its way up through between the pavements. It'll be here. It'll come here. But, you know, let's find ways of encouraging it, encouraging more species. And certainly let's not try and shut down nature when it shows up in cities, not sort of pretend it shouldn't be there. Let's encourage it. And we can do that by having parks that are not just kind of covered in grass, a few standard trees, but which are allowed to become wild again. Let's have more in Europe foxes, in North America coyotes and other things coming back into the cities and encourage that development. Let's see more of it. Conservationists have a great deal of work to be done in urban environments. You know, let's just not spend our time out in Yellowstone or wherever. Let's think more about the suburbs of Chicago or Dallas or New York or wherever. Huge amount of nature is already in these places, but we could have so much more.
Although we've covered a lot of ground in the conversation, we've really only scratched the surface of what is in your book, The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. Fred Pierce, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this.
It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.